hell of a big one.
I don't have it out yet. This is Eleanor Swent, and we're continuing the interview with Douglas First, and now this is October 26, 2001, and tape 38. Okay? Okay, and you had said that there were a few things more that you wanted to say about the organization in China, so let's just pick up with that today.
Yeah, the last time I mentioned that, you know, in the early 80s, we had a number of delegations come through here, and in those days there were a lot of so-called visiting scholars, and one of the visiting scholars in the mineral processing area named Liu spent, oh, maybe 6 months here working, not with me, but with Professor Sastry. But anyway, some months later, maybe either he'd gone back to China or it's while he was here, the Minister of Building Materials of China came through, and he wanted, you know, me to meet him. And so they have been on a delegation mostly in Canada, and I believe in relation to purchasing asbestos. You know, Canada, Quebec has big asbestos mines. And perhaps this is on the last leg back. And we had a nice dinner in a Chinese restaurant in San Francisco. And I remember asking the minister, probably through an interpreter, how many employees he had that worked for him. And he said, 10 million.
Oh, my.
Yeah, 10 million that were in the building ministry, of which he was responsible for all.
And this was just an agency.
There's a coal ministry, non-ferrous. Mm-hmm. When our first trip, we had dinner in Beijing, or in those days, Peking, with a minister of non-ferrous metallurgy in 79. But anyway, I learned a little bit more about the organization. In China, everything was then and until really quite recently organized vertically. There were universities for building materials. He had under him two or three medical schools for doctors, for building workers in building materials industry, etc.
Oh.
That's all the school system, and they were responsible for all the housing, for all the employees, and this was the structure of all these ministries of
So it wasn't just procurement.
No, it was that was their main object, but of course get make cement and, you know, get rock and whatever else would be involved, but everybody in the related to people working in the families were part of it. And by the way, I remember also in our discussions in 79, you know, many people, let's say a husband and wife, and in some cases I know they were both engineers, were assigned to go work maybe 1,000 miles apart, and the only 2 weeks vacation per year would they be able to get together. And that was very typical of the of people we talked to, and really kind of a sad state of existence, wasn't it?
Dehumanizing.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, also our last trip, which was about 3 years ago, that was paid for by the coal ministry. And in the coal ministry, again, it's organized at the universities for teaching coal mining, coal cleaning, etc. And at Huainan Institute was a medical school. And again, that medical school were training doctors for dealing with patients working in the coal mine industry.
Huh.
So, but about 3 years ago, this situation of owning the housing by the ministry, or each university had took care of the housing of all the faculty, all the employees. They were selling them off to the individuals. That was just beginning, in other words, to divest mm-hmm. that activity. But on the last trip in Beijing, I did give a lecture at the university related to coal mining, but we also spent a day at the Beijing Research Institute for Mining and Metallurgy. I was very impressed with those people, and that's where I first heard that they were just in the act of divesting their housing mm-hmm. to the employees. Mm. Now, how that would work in the long run, I have no idea, because housing obviously costs the employees just a few yuan, a few dollars a month, mm-hmm. because that was all, everything had been subsidized.
But they had no choice.
They had no choice. Mm-hmm. But then we also spent time at the, in fact, it was more of a consulting discussion time with a large group at the General Research Institute for Non-Ferrous Metallurgy. And this, the director there had said, was the largest or second largest research institute in China. Wow. And the previous president of this, Dian Zuo, D-I-N-A-N-Z-U-O Wang, had been, he's in the mineral processing area, done a lot of good work in flotation, so I knew of him technically. Mm-hmm. And he had been president of the Central South Institute of Mining and Metallurgy, or which is now Central South University of Technology at Changsha. And my former student, Soma Sundaran, had proposed that we nominate him for being a foreign member of the National Academy of Engineering. So we put that together. As I remember, Soma was a nominator. I was naturally acted as one of the seconders. And Wang became a foreign member of NAE, and when that happened, obviously his stature in China mushroomed, and he became the director of this huge non-ferrous institute. Mm-hmm. And now, as of when we were there 3 years ago, he was honorary president. In other words, he mm-hmm. had retired. Drove with us up to, in two big black limousines, up to the Great Wall, and we had a wonderful dinner with the...
Now, you said that you were very impressed with them. In what way? What impressed you about them? The Institute?
Oh, he had a very solid knowledge of technically in the field, and obviously he was a good director, good leader, although mm-hmm. a very, really, I would say, mild and quiet sort mm-hmm. of individual. Now, I could see in his successor, who hosted the dinner, a much more aggressive, more American-like approach. And this was somebody who had a PhD from University of Bristol in England. Mm-hmm. Would come back to China, and I could see that those years that he would have had in England gave him a much more outward approach to mm-hmm. to management and dealing with people than Wang. And now, as of about 2 years ago, Wang is now the vice president of the Chinese Academy of Engineering. Mm. And one can see the good that came to him out of his not being nominated by some of us and being elected as a as a foreign member of the U.S. National Academy. Mm-hmm. And
very prestigious.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, that gave him absolutely outstanding prestige in China. You know, I assume there's probably a couple other foreign members that are Chinese, but to me it's a good illustration of how that worked. And but I thought it was interesting to just comment on this vertical organization and the fact that the master said, "I have 10 million employees."
So different from our system.
Right, right.
Just completely different.
Anyway, I'm assuming things have changed. It'd be interesting to find out how they've accomplished this change, because it obviously is a difficult thing. For example, we were near Hainan. We visited a coal plant, big one, and the manager and the assistant manager. I remember sitting with them, and after we'd gone through the plant, I was very impressed with them. They, you know, you knew you were dealing with people that were right on top. It'd be like dealing with a mine manager of an American mine. You could tell you were he was smooth, knew how he was doing, etc. And he told me, though, that they were going to have to lay off something like, within a few months, 700 employees. In other words, China was changing from complete support of everybody to making, you know, to having to not run everything at a loss. I've never heard anything about, you know, what went on, but he did tell us that that was coming about in a very short order there.
That would be a big change.
Oh yeah, yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I just thought this would be good.
Well, do you want to move into capitalism in a big way? And we were going to talk today about your experience at Homestake as a director. That's kind of a jump from the ministry.
less people, less employees than 10 million, that's true. I was asked in the early, either late 1976 or early 1977 about being proposed to join the Homestake board. And
how did this invitation come?
Well, it came, I think, from a telephone call or a personal visit from Paul Henshaw, who was then the chairman of Homestake. But I never did ask the details of how that happened, but I have a feeling it really came through Don McLaughlin and Dee Videnski. And I had told you about the day the engineering college had for what they called distinguished alumni in all the departments, and that both McLaughlin and Videnski were extremely impressed with the talk I had put together. And I told you that Videnski told me he'd gone home that night and changed his will to leave stock for scholarships. And and you remember Videnski, of course. And, you know, he was about the vintage, or a little older possibly than Malazimov, but he too came from Russia, came white Russian, came to this country, no relatives in the country, and graduated from Cal in metallurgy in the late 20s, 1928 perhaps, and had risen to being the technology vice president, HANA, engineering vice president, and was on the board of Homestake. And it's my guess, without ever asking anybody, that when he retired, that was, he perhaps had proposed me as a replacement. And that's how I think that happened. Never asked.
So you did replace him then?
I don't know, but he was.
But I mean, you went on at the time that he went off.
When I was first on the board, they had three people that, what they call them, consultants to the board that came to every meeting. And one was Vedensky, who had retired. The other was Howard Vesper, who you must know, who had been president of California Chemical, Chevron Research.
Mm-hmm.
And John Gustafson, who was the previous president, chairman of Homestake. And Gustafson had come from HANA. He'd been chief geologist of HANA. That's my guess is how the Vedensky route came. You know, things tie together, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so for maybe a couple of years, or 3 years, these so-called consultants to the board would be, sit at the board table, obviously couldn't vote, but would participate in discussions, and they would all been, previous people. What I found interesting in thinking back about it, at that time were 12 board members, of which 6 were in-house. And 6 were outhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get that.
Right.
Just in case it's
enough,
important.
I think we
first
can
to know. Oh, good morning, Bill. Good and fine. You? Lee, I'm here with Lee this morning.
The phone rang then, and you were just talking about inside directors versus outside directors. That means those who were employed by the company.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I joined the board in February 7, 1977, the inside directors were chairman, CEO, president was Paul Henshaw, and Harry Conger, who later succeeded Henshaw. Frank Corbin, who was finance vice president, Don Delicate, who was, I suppose, was vice president of mining, I think it was.
He was manager at Lead.
And manager at Lead, but I think he had the other broader, and Don McLaughlin, who at that point would have been 86 years old, and Dick Storr, who was senior vice president. The outside directors were Cliff Heinbucher, who was a member of our, early member of our Mining Oral History Advisory Board, was, as you well recall, participated in the organization at your house. John Kiley, who had retired as the president of Bechtel Power Company. Kiley, I always considered, really one of the top civil engineers of his generation. Ted Marks, who was vice president of Castle and Cook, and Dole Pineapple, etc., in Hawaii, and Vern Shepman, who at that point was president of Envirotech, and Vern had been, I think, a member of the board since about 73, and and Ted Marks had come on board the year before I, and one other insider, I mean outsider, interesting, was Jim Salisbury, and who had, I guess had been on the board since the late 40s, and Salisbury was, I used to sit down by him, he'd sit at the end of the table and smoke a pipe almost constantly, some smoking was allowed, I guess, but his grandfather had a freight hauling company in Wyoming and in the Dakotas territory, and hauled all the early equipment into Homestake, and I guess was paid off in stock. So Salisbury was a major stockholder of Homestake, and but that came about due to this ancient history of his grandfather's freight company. You probably know more about that story than I know.
I didn't know that. Now, you didn't identify Heimbucher. He was an accountant, wasn't he?
Heimbucher, apparently very good, because he had been even, I think, president of the National Association involved with accounting. And he was the finance vice president, I assume, of Varian. And had that career for a long time. Apparently, he was, an outstanding person in his field. So that made a total of a board of 12 with 50-50 split. And later on, and I think towards the end of 1977, Wally McGregor joined the board, and you probably knew.
Yes.
Wally from way back, because I think he'd been 1 year a vice president of Homestake sometime
in the
50s or about maybe 1960. And then a lot of his career was at Amex and Climax and
Kaiser
Aluminum. I think he was executive vice president of Kaiser. This is after my day there. But and just at the time he joined the board, he was serving a year or two as the president of Peabody Coal. You may have learned a little of this in your interview with Frank Jockley, but Peabody Coal had been bought by Kennecott when they were kicked out of Chile, and they took the money and bought Peabody Coal, and then the wisdom of our people in Washington said that Kennecott had to divest themselves of Peabody Coal. Before Peabody got attached to whatever they did, for an interim couple of years, Wally McGregor was the president, and so Wally became a board member, and McGregor, I think, upon retiring from Peabody, considered himself a mineral financial consultant and worked in that way.
Let's see, you had done some interesting compilations of figures.
My whole time on the board was 22 years. Probably Byrne Shipman may have done a couple of years older than I am, may have been there a total of 23. But that was, as you can imagine, long long service. 1977, I tabulated, looking at annual reports, just out of general interest, the 1977, the revenue of the company was $159 million, and it grew fairly steadily, reaching something like $520 million in 1987. The high point was 1966 at $998 million, and 1999, $748. The total revenues during my years on the board were $12.3 billion. I also tabulated out of my interest the expenditures that they had for exploration, because apparently they made a decision to increase exploration quite significantly when they hired Jim Anderson as vice president for for exploration shortly before, I don't know, maybe a year or so before I got there. Anyway, exploration was, you know, 1977 was, $10 million, increased to $22 million in 1981, was running over practically more than a dozen years, was running something like 40s and 50 million, and 1997 I see was something like, according to the annual report, $68 million. When you sum all of these, and in those 22 years, exploration totaled $709 million, which is in round numbers about 6% of revenues. And I always find interesting tabulations of what different industries spend on research. You know, they'll say the metallurgical industry spends 1%, or and the pharmaceuticals, I don't know, 10-20%, and maybe the chemical industry 3-4%. These you see regularly, and when this sort of thing is summarized. Well, if one looks at exploration to a mining company as if it's a as research, in other words, it's finding new ore deposits, just like research in pharmaceuticals is finding, let's say, a new drug. Mm-hmm. Then Homestake spent, approximately 6%, quote unquote, on research, and that's different than, often you think in terms of research as metallurgical research in a mining company. So I think that's really, to me, was quite a significant number.
Do you have any idea how that compares with other mining companies?
Not really, except that years ago, Malazimov was visiting, and it's before I had any relationship with him, but he's just visiting the department and so on, and I remember he said that at that time, Homestake may have spent $17-18 million on exploration, and he said that Newmont that year had spent $23 million, almost all of it in Nevada, he commented. In other words, they were spending their money in the geographic area that they knew. So I can just throw that out. I haven't done this kind of analysis at all. Of course, I found it very fascinating reading David Lowell's oral history, and one that's a
interesting perspective on exploration expenditures and what accomplishments are, by reading an oral history of somebody who devoted his whole life very successfully to that very,
yes, indeed,
to that very point. Okay. Hey, I would like, I'm here at the University of California, and you well know, you are too, so you,
right,
you've gained a little bit of what can, how things are approached here. There's complete freedom of speech, and people can say what they want and write what they want. And I guess as long as it's PC, politically correct, because if it's not PC, you can't say what it is. But I'd like to just read to you a short letter to the editor of the Daily Californian, dated April 13, 1977. And there was a now retired professor of physics, Charles Schwartz, who almost on all matters expressed his opinion, and he was a major thorn during the Vietnam War, and I think a major thorn in the side of the director of LBL, etc., and etc. But this letter, which I think is important, the headline was Hearst's, and the letter is addressed to the icebox. Charter Day brought honors, I'll give you a copy, but I'll read it. Charter Day brought honors to Donald McLaughlin, former UC Dean of Engineering, UC Regent, and President and Chairman of Homestake Mining Companies. Friday's Daily Californian article also mentions that he was a friend of the Hearst family, apparently unaware that Homestake Mine, parentheses, now $130 million a year corporation, closed parentheses, was the original source of the Hearst family fortune. This bit on
back just a little bit there, just last sentence. Uh-huh.
Homestake Mining Company just announced a new addition to its board of directors, Professor Douglas Furstenow, Chairman of Berkeley's Department of Materials Science and Engineering. Charter Day is a time when we can all pause, recall our rich heritage, and ask anew, quote, whose university is this? Close quote. Charles Schwartz, Professor of Physics.
What was his point, I wonder?
That Hearst controlled the university, I guess.
I see, uh-huh.
And I want that as part of this, because
we can put this in the appendix.
Maybe that's a place to,
right,
to because he
mm-hmm.
Schwartz, probably every time there was any demonstration down at Sproul Hall, you knew, or Sproul Plaza, there was Charlie Schwartz at the microphone.
So he thought you were a tool of the Hearst.
Tool of the Hearst.
Well.
By the way, it's only recently that I did see in buying a book called related to the Copper Wars in Butte, Montana, that Hearst, George Hearst, did own 50% of the Homestake Mine himself. And that he owned 39% of Anaconda,
mm-hmm.
And when he died, his wife Phoebe Apperson Hearst sold Anaconda. That was obviously one big mistake at the time. But the fortune that started with them in mining was obviously already made you. I
was trying to recall the Patty Hearst abduction was earlier than this, of course, wasn't it? That was the late 60s. I think that was it.
Yeah, I guess so.
You were not a child.
So Hearst would have been, and you know, her mother was a regent. I remember her mother coming, seeing her on occasion, because once in a while they'd come through Hearst Mining Building. And one time, Don McLaughlin brought Mrs. Hearst, whatever.
Catherine Hearst.
Mm-hmm. A regent to see the bust of Phoebe Hearst, which was right in the, you know, always in the lobby of Hearst Mining Building. Only the bust was in the broom closet.
Oh no.
Well, I'll tell you, Phoebe's bust was back out
in the lobby
shortly thereafter, and there was a lady janitor, some not too much later, that was very industrious, and at night had decided that Phoebe needed polishing, and so she took sandpaper and sandpapered off the patina.
Oh my.
on this bust. Bronze casting of Phoebe Hearst. Mm. Well, anyway, Buildings and Grounds agreed to pay for having Phoebe repatinaed. And then there was a huge bronze casting of George Hearst on the wall, and she had started to sandpaper the copper oxide from it, and down in one corner for a few inches, you could see where she had. Decided, you know, to clean this up.
Oh dear.
So anyway, that little bit of the tie, but back, you know, back in the 77 era. Gold must have been less than a quarter of the revenues of home state. You know, uranium was major and lead, and I know
they had the iron in Australia.
Hey, you know, that was before me, I guess.
Okay.
I guess when they brought in Gustafson as president, the idea was, because then gold was only $35 an ounce, mm-hmm. and it had to diversify, and I gather that is where the idea of bringing Gustafson to Homestead, was that kind of the scuttlebutt you might have known from Langan?
We were in New Mexico, and I don't
know. Yeah, they also at that time were drilling for copper up in the Michigan Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Wally McGregor one time saying some years later, boy, we're sure lucky we never hit any copper.
And they had the brick plant in Port Costa, of course.
I didn't know that.
That was before. Yeah, they did all kinds of things.
But it had to, with $35 gold, you had to. Mm-hmm. See, that one I was unaware of. And I do know of the forest products up there in the Black Hills.
So when you came on, they were still not just gold, but beginning to concentrate.
Well, there were discussions about increasing the gold.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always a multiplier on the value of the stock based on gold, mm-hmm. which unfortunately it's the other way around today, because of the lag in the gold price. But there, you know, were also efforts internationally. Madrigal down in Peru. Was Langan Did he go down to Peru? He must have been involved with that because of that needed a lot of attention, I gather, and which was copper, lead, zinc. Don McLaughlin, unlike the Madrigal region, because he figured there's great potential in the region, I'm speaking geologically. But eventually Home State sold that. But early on, a lot of discussion took place over KMA, Calgrilli Mining Associates, over the 50% ownership that Home State had in the Mount Charlotte mine. And in those days, again with the $35 gold, it was, this to me, it was my impression, kind of baling wire kind of operation, that lots of discussion was, you know, should any more money be spent there, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, you could, that went on. And,
what particular expertise did you bring to the board?
As Paul Henshaw, if I remember, saying that, well, you're not being asked to come on the board technically, but for your general input on advice and judgment on board matters. So I naturally, did comment on technical matters, but I think after a lot of years around the university dealing with people and solving problems and assessing approaches, I could apply the same thoughts and to plans and so on that came up to the Home State Board. In committees that I served on were for a lot of time, in fact, for quite a while, compensation committee, which really determine, you know, compensation levels really for the two top people. That's a real that's your real concern, and approve general compensation matters. Often, usually, the consultants were there whenever there was a change in plans, and it eventually became the concept of employment contracts, things like that. So all of this would go through that. Later years, it became an environmental committee, for example, that was became very important, and that's where I think the people who are engineers might have been on that committee. Committees are, manned by the, or personed by the, by the outside directors in general, although there will be the inside person, often the chairman or president would naturally be a, I don't remember now whether a member of the committee or an ad hoc member of the committee, but and some of these legally, like audit committee and so on, must be outsiders. Later on, shortly, a couple of years after I was on the board, Bob Jedicke, who was a professor of accounting at Stanford was named to the board, and this probably took place with the departure of Cliff Heimbucher. And about the time this was in, he was announced to become a board member, he also became dean of the business school at Stanford. And so he, now his expertise, in addition to the, let's say, broad expertise, you know, covered the accounting. You know, he was chairman of the audit committee, etc. And I know he had that kind of role, and maybe on finance committee. You know, somebody who had been company president of another company would, you know, serve on finance committee, maybe audit committees, and you know, and so on.
Compensation committee was your principal.
And nomination, there's also nomination, nominating committee, which were bringing in new board members. Mm-hmm. For a long time, Homestake had a fairly young board after Conger became chairman. And at that point, a policy was instituted that, which I think is a good policy, although was that board members should retire at age 70. And so we had board members and consultant to board that were getting into high 80s and low 80s, etc. And it was my duty to go around and tell them they're going to be retired from the board. I had to go discuss this with Don McLaughlin, for example. And it's my role as chairman of the nominating committee. So then, though, there was quite a large number of board members were, let's say, early 50s, so several people were invited to be on the board that upon their retirement from other companies. So it was kind of a nice luxury that Homestake had, and one would be Bob, and I'll get his name. Who?
Durham. Durham.
No. I mean, I'm coming to him later. Retired as a chairman of Rosario.
Oh yeah. Reinecke.
Bob Renninger. German Reiniger, but Renninger he called. Yeah, so here we had the opportunity of having him serve on the board for 5 years between, you know, his 65 to 70. And another person was Bull Durham, who had been head of Phelps Dodge, and when he and I remember Bull telling me when he retired from as chairman of Phelps Dodge, they wanted him to stay on the board, and he said no, he was going to leave. He wanted to turn it, which I think is the right way to do it, to turn it over to the new management, mm-hmm. and let it be them, and not have him as a former board member, mm-hmm. looking over their shoulder, or people coming to him when they should really be going to the new whatever direction mm-hmm. they take. But as the years began to pass, all of a sudden, various people aged, and mm-hmm. so that luxury was gone, because all of a sudden, in the last handful of years, were about two retirements per year in the last, let's say last half dozen years were one or two retirements every year because of this aging phenomenon. The only other eventually older board member was Hadley Case, who came with some Case Pomeroy from when the home state merged with took over Felmont Oil Company, and Hadley was, you know, well in his 80s, and but when you owned a major percentage of the company, you were on the board.
Made an exception.
Oh yeah, and Hadley was still contributing very well until you know, when he finally had decided to step down late in late 80s. But then you know, women on board members, you once asked just in there about women, and well, let me say another aspect of home state board. Since home state had a major, the major thing of South Dakota, you always wanted to have somebody from South Dakota, and early on, you know, as uranium in Colorado and Creed in Colorado, input of somebody from there. And so we had well, Don Delicate for a number of years was on the board, but then stepped down later on. But a banker from the Norwest Bank, I'll give you the name.
You had the Frontier Airlines man too.
I'm about to get to him, but the, the banker was there for several years, but then he was transferred to Omaha, and that person doesn't serve a purpose anymore, and so he stepped down. You wanted somebody in South Dakota, and whereas he'd been in Rapid City. But then another one that turned out to be a very good board member was Glenn Ryland, who was chairman of Frontier. And the idea with him was, of course, he was there in Denver. And he you know, was a good contact for the Denver region. And of course, there was all of the environmental stuff going on with the uranium property, and so I'm assuming you know, Ryland was helpful in making contacts with the governor and the pitch mine, and you know, etc. But Frontier had all its problems with unions and so on, and eventually Ryland and Frontier parted ways, and he moved back out here, stayed on the board. He was a good board member, and eventually Frontier was taken over by somebody else, and so on. Now I think there's a new Frontier Airlines, but it's just a local one. But coming on back to South Dakota, some years ago, I'd had some dealings with my brother, with one of his former students, who devised a device for accurate cataract operations, and they formed a small company, and well, I bought some invested in it, and so on. And anyway, they had an excellent young woman originally, well, fairly young woman originally from South Dakota named Carol Ray, and is the head of it. And anyway, from my dealings with when this took place, I really realized that, you know, he was a very capable woman. I think she came from Rapid City, and I think maybe then was living in Tucson or something like that. But he'd come back to be head of this company, and anyway, one day it occurred to me that now there's somebody in South Dakota, somebody, and I think she was an officer at the national level on the Chamber of Commerce in Washington, too. I mean, in other words, not employed, but in some kind of role. That there would be somebody in South Dakota, a very capable person and a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I made the suggestion, and I guess I was on a trip when she came out and interviewed various board members and so on, but they all were impressed, and she was elected to the board and has served very admirably.
You broke that one open.
Oh yeah, that was. It's interesting how it just hit me one morning that hey, there takes care of. One, we get a woman on the board, but we take care of the South Dakota board. And she apparently had had much interaction with the governor and knew her way around the state and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And Homestake eventually. Moved more and more to becoming a gold company. Of course, the high price of gold
helped
give the incentive for doing that.
Now you were on the board when the Corona acquisition came.
That was a major acquisition. Corona. I'd been read by in the newspapers maybe about the suit between Corona and LAC over that Hemlo dispute that LAC Mining Company. I guess Corona had been given the option to the mine by the owner, but somehow she turned around and I think it was a she gave it. After signing some papers, gave it to LAC Minerals, and that ended up, I think, a trial of many years, and eventually Corona won that, and so LAC had already put in the mine and maybe was building the mill or built the mill. So when Corona got it, I guess they paid back to LAC the money that LAC had put in the development of it. And I gather a Corona employee that was one of their main witnesses was always Peter Steen, who was at the time Corona was taken over, was president of Corona. But as I recall, Corona was in really very bad financial shape, owed and really in debt, and so Homestake was able to acquire them because they were very close to imploding due to the debt. And from that, of course, came these wonderful Hemlo mines and but eventually it was developed Eskate Creek. Eskate Creek is a kind of operation that, or mine that, God, you we'd love to have lots of. As I remember, Randy runs it, was at the time 80 ounces of silver, 2+ ounces of gold, and a few percent zinc and maybe a little trace of lead per ton. Basically, it was a sulfide. And a lot of discussion was is over whether to mill it or build a mill, which would probably be a hydrometallurgical plant, or to just direct ship it. And finally, the decision was made to just ship it, and half of it went to Japan, and maybe the other half, in round numbers, to Naranda, I think, in eastern Canada. And that, as you can well imagine, you're not ending up with an environmental problem, etc. So it turns out that you don't have to invest in the mill.
Solve that problem.
Solve the problem of capital, solve really this long-range environmental problem. Can you imagine having a tailings that's basically residual from an ore that's virtually all sulfide? Mm-hmm. You know, one of my former students worked for Exxon Minerals, and you may remember years ago Exxon found in Wisconsin a huge deposit. I forget what they called it.
Began with a C.
But it ran something like 6% zinc, I think. I think it was basically a zinc deposit, but all of the tailings were pyrite. Mm-hmm. And what would you do with these tailings, pyrite tailings? There may have been a little, some copper in, but I vaguely remember it was mostly zinc, but a rich deposit and huge. Anyway, it was all put to bed, the decision made not to mine it because of how to handle the environmental aspects of a tailings that would be completely pyrite. Maybe generations from now they'll have to go to a deposit like that. But there was one that was put aside. But Eske Creek is a
it's a jewel, isn't it?
It was a jewel, yeah, it truly was. Mm-hmm. And
so you were on the board when they voted to acquire that then?
Oh yeah, right. And
did that bring in new board members?
It brought in two new board members, two good ones, and Peter Steen is president of the company, mm-hmm. and he was then a board member, and Norman Anderson, who I think was functioning as, I may be wrong, but I think he was functioning as a chairman and probably non-CEO chairman of Corona. I think that mm-hmm. where Norm Anderson came in, he had been chairman, I think, of Cominco at one time and so on, and of course a solid mining conservative financial.
Did the Canadian aspect make any difference? Was there any, the fact that he was Canadian, Peter Steen was Canadian also, well actually Peter Steen was South African, wasn't he?
Peter Steen was originally a South African, and whether he went to Canborne School of Mines, mm-hmm. I just know that from reading, and then whether he's a Canadian citizen.
I just wondered whether that, you know, would make any difference in a person's attitudes or
didn't seem to. I think if I remember now from talking with Norm Anderson, his father or grandfather was American, mm-hmm. but working in Canada and maybe as an engineer.
Porous border in the mining
world. Yeah, and so whereas Anderson himself was born in Canada and mm-hmm. native, but he, I believe, ran the Cominco operation, you know, at the Buick mine.
Oh, in Missouri.
In Missouri, you know, Cominco had an adjacent mm-hmm. mine, and I think he told me for a while he was a manager there, mm-hmm. and. So, you know, paths kind of interestingly crossed, not close, but I don't know whether Harry knew him at that point or not. I would have no idea, but because at that point Harry was a liaison to early on to.
And he had, of course, had worked in British Columbia for a while.
True enough. So it's an international. Mm-hmm. Situation.
So that was one of the big events. What was another?
Another big one, of course, was, well, there were two or three. Of course, the Felmont acquisition was really, I think Hadley Case wanted to sell out Felmont, and they owned one quarter what's the big open pit there in Nevada? Round Mountain.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So that interested. Perhaps Homestake, and I think Don McLaughlin had consulted in length for Hadley Case's father in Kalgoorlie or in Australia decades earlier. So see, there's the contact didn't come out of the cold, but Felmont brought, oil with it, and so for some years, Homestake.